Hello, it's Bill Nelson here again, the director of the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins. And today we're going to spend a little time with Drew Pardoll, who is the professor here and director of the Bloomberg Kimmel Institute for Cancer Immunology and Immunotherapy. And of course, Drew is one of our nation's leading immunologists who've been trying to figure out ways to harness the power and the specificity of the immune system to attack cancer and cancer cells. And why don't we just start with that? Drew, as you know, there's been aspirations to use the immune system to combat cancers in individual patients that go back more than a century. But over time, there's a number of things we've learned about how the immune system works that make us ever more excited that we're A, starting to do so, and B, can do so even better in the future. Why do we think that the immune system can recognize a cancer as different than our normal cells in the body so that it can chase after it?
By first scientific principles, the immune system should arguably be the strongest anti-cancer weapon. If you look at how effectively the immune system deals with 99.9% of the infections that we're exposed to on a virtually daily basis, you can see its specificity, because in almost all the cases, other than getting symptoms of a cold, we barely register that our immune system is doing that much work. The immune system has a number of weapons, probably as many as 15 different ways of killing infected cells. And those mechanisms, those weapons are, we know, are effective against cancer cells. And finally, the immune system has memory, which is why our childhood vaccines protect us for life. And what that suggests, and this is now finally being borne out, that if we can empower the patient's immune system to go after their cancer, we can stop treating after a relatively short period of time, and the immune system then takes over and does the rest of the work.
So that's an interesting backstory, if you will, which is the notion that you can use tools or, you know, reagents or strategies to direct the immune system where you want it to go. And perhaps the best example of that is this long history of using vaccines. So it's like sort of faking certain elements of an infection, and the immune system marshals its resources to recognize this. And because, as you've described, it maintains memory, then if you've been vaccinated against smallpox, the immune system remembers that and is even better able to thwart the threat of smallpox should it show up at some time in the future. Now, this was one of the first things that the cancer immunologists like you really tried to do. Can we generate vaccines that instruct the immune system to chase after cancer cells? And by and large, it seems, as an observer like me, that you clearly generated anti-human immune responses. That was good. They never seemed to be strong enough to go after large cancers promote their rejection, at least not often enough that that's our only strategy. What was going on there?
Well, this was one of the frustrations that kept myself and my colleagues up many nights. Seeing that we could generate immune responses against...
In people, that you could measure.
In people against tumor antigens, which are essentially the signatures of cancer, that the immune system is able to use to recognize it. But right, that rarely, anecdotally, some amazing clinical regressions, but it was really only anecdotal. And that led us, based on the notion, if this is true, what does it imply, to begin to start looking within the tumor to see, with the notion that the tumor was putting up barriers against the activity of those immune cells that the vaccine induced. And that turns out to be the case, and the immune target that's really exploded the field of immunotherapy called PD-1. Its partners are called PD-L1 and PD-L2, that this inhibitory pathway, these breaks on the immune system, we call them checkpoints, were highly upregulated in the tumor microenvironment. And I look at it like the vaccine is pushing on the accelerator in a car where the parking brake has been thrown on. You don't move it very quickly. The key is that now that we understand what the parking brakes are, that gives us really the platform to disable the parking brakes. And I think that's going to lead to these combination therapies of pushing on the gas, of which vaccines are one, while disabling the parking brakes to really get the immune system most effectively revved up against their cancer.
So here's a question in the general knowledge of through thinking about ways to direct and redirect the immune system to go after cancer and other dread diseases, I think it's fair to say that as immunologists, you all are learning more and more about how the immune system works and the various details of what it's up to at any given time. And one of the ways that the immune system works to recognize and then thwart an infection is to muscle up all kinds of cells with a lot of weaponry to go kill infectious agents and the like. And as that threat subsides, then to evolve in a direction where there isn't so much weaponry anymore, but a lot more memory. So it's ready to move in the future, perhaps making antibodies that can interfere with a future attempt at an infection and the like. In other words, it behaves differently at different times after the threat has appeared. It evolves a response that changes in character. And one of the thoughts is that you need to evolve a response that changes in character, or you start to get friendly fire problems where the immune system gets so revved up, it damages normal cells and tissues. And in a sense, this is already something you know you're flirting with these immune checkpoint inhibitors and drugs in this pathway, because that seems to be the kind of side effect you see. It's as if the immune system got very revved up and caused something with the end itis on it, which is the immune system injuring some other tissue. Is that what you think is going on, that you're trying to improve the veracity of a particular step and then ultimately hope that there's a resolution of the immune response with memory and that we just have to push on levers to get there?
I think that there are ways to enhance anti-tumor immunity with a lower level of collateral damage. Absolutely, the so-called checkpoint inhibitors that disable the brakes, their side effects are immunologic, revving up the immune system against normal tissues. It can be colitis, which is an inflammation of the gut, sometimes a lot of inflammation in the thyroid, which actually can be managed, but you certainly see this. The first checkpoint inhibitor, called anti-CTLA-4, had a very high rate of immune side effects. But we were very excited, even a little bit surprised, to see that the next checkpoint inhibitor, this PD-1 checkpoint, had much, much greater anti-tumor activity than anti-CTLA-4, and actually had lower immune side effects, lower immune toxicity rate than anti-CTLA-4, but still significant. And now that so many patients are being treated with this, even a small proportion, maybe 4 to 5% of significant immune toxicities of a very large number, our rheumatologists are getting a lot of business. We think that this is where, for example, potentially a vaccine that can target the immune system much more closely or much more specifically is going to further expand that so-called therapeutic window. The other key insight that we're really poised to leverage is the appreciation that the mutations that make cancer happen, that drive cancer, create biochemical signatures that the immune system can recognize. And since those mutations are only in the cancer and not in normal cells, we have some opportunities there, again, to more specifically target the cancer cell and improve our therapeutic window. This is something that I see evolving over the next 10, 20 years.
So that being something very exciting, I think you could argue for a century, the question was, can the immune system see the cancer in the way that it sees an infectious threat such that it could recognize and destroy it? I think at this point you'd have to say not only yes, but it sees it for the very reason that it is a cancer, which seems very logical on some level in terms of a rational.
But not obvious 25 years ago.
It wasn't. As you know, that the people like you who worked on this were, you know, working hard and having to endure skepticism from all manners of stuff. And, you know, I think that there's no question that that answer is a resounding yes. And it's the basis for the enthusiasm of going forward. Another question I have for you is that the minute you sort of think about regulating an immune system and the way it responds to something, where you know it's capable of astonishing things in terms of destroying cells, destroying organisms, et cetera, there's going to be a lot of these checkpoints, more than just one or two, that are going to be layered on in terms of shaping and regulating the immune system to be sure that it kills what we want to have killed and leaves alone what we want to leave alone. How many other such checkpoints, if you will, are there, and how many of them do you expect to be targeted productively with drugs like the anti-CTLA-4 and the anti-PD-1, anti-PD-L1 type of drugs?
At this point, if one takes a broad view of checkpoints, I think the answer would be as many as 40 or 50. Of those, there are probably at this point 10 that are being targeted clinically at this time. In most cases, the studies are relatively early, so the jury is out. But I think that among those additional 50 checkpoints, there are probably 10 to 20 that are going to be fruitful. However, and this is very important, the personalized or precision medicine piece of immunotherapy comes from the fact that not every tumor uses the same checkpoints. And so we strongly believe that for this to be successful, we need to look at which checkpoints are being expressed in various tumors in order to guide us for our therapy. So that's my version of precision immunotherapy. And I think to do these clinical trials without incorporating this kind of biomarker information may, in a lot of cases, throw out the baby with the bathwater.
So you're sort of responding to the notion that making protein-type drugs, antibody-like drugs, to the components of all these various checkpoints is something we, small w, in the whole field of cancer immunotherapy and biopharma know we can do. We can do that. The question is, when we build them, how can we most responsibly and most expeditiously find the ones that work and who they work for in such a way that they can be tested in a economical way and gotten to the point of care the fastest? And biomarkers, you believe, trying to measure which checkpoints are being used by which cancer to outfox the immune system in an individual patient is going to be the root. Is that sort of what you're thinking?
That's absolutely the case. And I'll take it a step further to say that the technologies that exist today allow us to do that. We don't have to invent new technologies to look at biopsies of the tumor, to look at things like circulating tumor DNA, to be able to actually assess the expression of those targets in a given tumor. So quite frankly, there's no excuse for our field, to not really be doing this in earnest as a central component to the clinical trials that we do. Regrettably, that isn't that oftentimes done, but I think that there is now becoming more and more of a realization, even among pharma and biotech, that investing a little bit more in the clinical trial to do this is going to, in the long run, pay off.
So a little bit to add on in some interesting ways that particularly the Bloomberg Kimmel Institute has unmasked or uncovered, or some of the people there have been working on. One is that, you know, I think we've gotten comfortable, as we've learned about how the immune system works, to understand what it is that the T cells, the smart cells of the immune system, see when they're looking at a normal cell and a cancer cell. But the other thing we're learning is that they have the ability to sense their environment in a number of ways as well. In particular, that basically what they eat and what's available in the environment that they can eat and their own metabolism affects greatly the decisions they'll make about whether they're activated to destroy something and to convince other cells to come in and destroy something versus whether they're going to prefer to become a memory cell or whatnot. This is this metabolism, and we think a lot about tumor metabolism, but I think what the Bloomberg Kimmel Institute investigators are finding is these metabolic pressures or these metabolic environments, the immune system sees very well as well. How's that going to play out?
Without question, there is no cell in the body that does its thing without regulating metabolism. Most people, when you say metabolism, you think of diabetes, you think of obesity. The reality is that there are two ways that metabolism comes into play with regard to the immune system. One is that just in general, various metabolic pathways, various substrates and metabolites affect the direction that the immune system is going to go. That's number one. The second thing is that in the tumor, there is a competition for nutrients between the tumor cell and the immune cells.
It seems like all ecosystems involve a competition for food, and this is one of them, right?
The tumor microenvironment is absolutely no exception. The exciting thing is, and I think this is why metabolism is one of the great, very new, hugely important frontiers in cancer immunotherapy, is that it's turning out that there are ways to shift the balance away from being in favor of the tumor and in favor of the immune cells, T cells and other cells that are actually sitting in the tumor and in part are not able to do their job perfectly because the tumor is stealing nutrients. This is a huge area. It's very new, but I think this is going to really be a major part of this expanding immunotherapy horizon.
And the insights that are going to be gained are going to have treatment implications. That's what
absolutely treatment implications.
Another one that the Bloomberg Kimmel Institute investigators are chasing after is this notion that the immune system knows all and sees all. So if you look at the number of microorganisms that are carried around on the body, many of them in the gut, in the intestines, the estimate is at least 10 times the number of our own cells, that the immune system sees this and it monitors what's going on. And depending on what the character of these multitudinously different microorganisms in the gut and elsewhere, the immune system might respond to things not only in the gut, which obviously has been taken on, but even elsewhere differently. It may affect the entire attitude, for lack of a better description, of the immune system on any given day. These are very interesting and exciting. Where's that going to go?
So this is the other hot area in development. You mentioned that just if you look in our gut, there are 10 times as many bacteria by the numbers as there are cells in our body. What a lot of people don't realize is that over 50% of the T cells in your body live in your gut or in gut-associated lymphoid tissue, essentially are gut-associated at a given time. The other thing is that most cells in the immune system are nomadic. So a cell that's in your gut today 2 weeks from now could be in your left toe, because the immune system is a circulating immune system. So you put all that information together, and a lot of information developing about how the immune system in the gut is being modulated by particular bacterial species, and they're probably among those huge numbers of bacteria, probably about 4,000 to 5,000 different species of bacteria represented, that that this is going to affect your systemic immune system, as well as your local immune response. And so there are two ways that this plays. One is that certain bacteria can actually activate cancer-promoting immune responses. Those are the bad guys. There are other bacteria that look like they promote anti-cancer immunity and can, in fact, enhance the activity of systemic immunotherapies. So when you put all that together, it makes sense that manipulation of the gut bacterial population, we call that the microbiome, by what I call scientifically guided probiotics, will be an additional piece of the armamentarium for immunotherapy. There are some very interesting new technologies that, for example, the sequencing technologies that can literally tell you from a stool sample what are the 5,000 species.
It's like the census. They can tell you who everybody is in there, right?
Absolutely. And you now compare those components of the census with the outcomes of patients being treated with immunotherapy. And now there are so many patients being treated, the majority of them don't respond, 20% or so across the board do respond. And you can say, okay, when you have these particular bugs, your probabilities of responding are much higher. We can even reconstitute the human microbiome in what are called germ-free mice. These are essentially bubble boy mice that you give them the human microbiome and they're reconstituted. So we can test whether these bugs that correlate with good responses in patients actually can do so in the mice. We can hone down to maybe 5 or 4 or 3 or whatever bugs, and then we can give them in a pill. That's really the vision, and it's no longer science fiction.
So the last thing that I wanted you to explore with you, so you can help us all understand, is there's another tactic which has gained a lot of attraction and benefiting people, FDA approved products, lots of things in the lay press, and this is along the rationale that you've outlined for us, which is one approach is to take immune cells out of this microenvironment where somehow they've been put asleep, held at check, or whatever is going on, and manipulate them outside of the body in some way to redirect their specificity or to activate them in some sustaining way or something, reintroduce them back into the body and see what they can accomplish. This CAR T cell. Now, we've seen just limited ones now redirecting specificity against things that aren't really tumor specific yet, but one can imagine moving forward. Where do you think this is going to go? Are we going to be vaccinating people against things that are tumor specific, recovering T cells that are wandering around in the body, making sure that they don't get turned off or coerced into not functioning by the microenvironment? And sticking them back in, that the engineering is going to be to make them more aggressive, not just to redirect their specificity. What's your thinking about this adoptive kind of treatment where you use the person's own immune cells, change them in some way, and give them back?
Yeah, so this is sometimes referred to as engineered adoptive cell therapy, as you described. This, until relatively recently, was viewed as an interesting idea, but one that was too personalized and too difficult to actually scale to a large number of patients, and to essentially do in a consistent way. And so there were literally two or three groups in the country that were doing this, and it was viewed sort of as something very boutique, experimental. The breakthrough literally has come within the last few years, in which the first proof of principle, which is engineering T cells to recognize an antigen that is expressed on all B cells, but also the vast majority of cancers derived from B cells, certain leukemias and certain lymphomas that are derived from B cells that also express this. You engineer these cells outside of the body, you give them back to the patient, and they have extremely potent activity against the tumor cells, but they also wipe out the patient's B cells. That's kind of how you know they're working. It turns out that you can actually live without your B cells, because what your B cells do is they make antibodies. And if you actually, you can actually purify antibodies from groups of normal individuals, concentrate them down, give them back to the patient, and the patient can actually do reasonably well. The important thing is that about 5 years ago, for the first time, a pharmaceutical company, Novartis, said, "We think that we can commercialize this. We think we can make a profit by treating a large number of patients." And a number of other companies jumped in, and there are now two FDA approvals. There will be a third FDA approval. It's still a work in progress to actually monetize it, but it is actually happening with this proof of principle. This is scratching the surface in what we can do in engineering T cells, but the fact that there is now two examples, a proof of principle that this is viewed as something that is scalable, commercializable, has injected a lot of investment into this field. So I think that is going to drive it forward. Again, these are not going to be commercialized tomorrow, but this is going to be, I think, a big thing. I really look at it over a decade's vision.
So you've sketched out a landscape for the next decade that's incredibly compelling. We have antibody drugs targeting these immune checkpoints already FDA approved, and a whole set of new ones to be evaluated, hopefully rationally and quickly. We have cells FDA approved, hopefully more and better ideas to be approved in the future, get to the point of care rationally and expeditiously. And cancer immunotherapy is definitely the way to go in the future. And so we've been here with Drew Pardoll, one of the leading cancer immunologists in the world, the director of the Bloomberg Kimmel Institute for Cancer Immunology and Immunotherapy. And I'm Bill Nelson, director of the Kimmel Cancer Center. And thanks for joining us again.